With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The United States Border Patrol has exciting and rewarding career opportunities with the nation's largest law enforcement organization. Border Patrol agents enjoy great pay, outstanding federal benefits, and up to $20,000 in recruitment incentives for newly appointed agents. If you are looking for a way to serve something greater than yourself, consider the United States Border Patrol. Learn more online at cbp.gov/careers/USBP. That's cbp.gov/careers/USBP.
We made USAA insurance for veterans like James. When he found out how much USAA was helping members save, he said,
it's time to switch.
We'll help you find the right coverage at the right price. USAA. What you're made of, we're made for. Restrictions apply.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
Welcome back to part two of this interview with Neville Keithley, otherwise known as Baloui Sum. We talk about the highlights of his career, his support slot with Queen, and how in 2019, after going back on stage, he was surprised by the reaction of the audience.
What's amazing to me is, a number of things here. I want to start with Carlos, because Carlos Alomar was... His riff was Fame, wasn't it, as well? He was more Bowie.
I mean, all the way through. With Robert Fripp, with Heroes, everything. I mean, Carlos is there all the way through, from Young Americans all the way through.
Which is, you know, and the connections, the sort of Bowie connection with you is sort of amazing, because it's like, you know, there's the childhood idol is Bowie, and then you're connecting again later on. And one thing that's really interesting there is that the idea that record companies at that point still had money, didn't they?
And it was a fortune. They were making fortunes. So the thing was, I was talking to someone the other day, you probably remember this. Basically, they bargained, it was about 100 grand a single. You didn't spend 100 grand, but you went in, it cost, studios were between 12 and 1500 quid a day. Now, you know, it's 50 quid and a packet of crisps, isn't it? I mean, it's just a different world. You're right, they had a fortune. But I didn't chase David Bowie's people. It's just that they were an incredible musical entity, you know. And if I can just throw in, because I'm talking, but it wasn't well received that I'd gone to New York. It was, you know, but you're English. What are you doing in New York? You know, you should be making English records for English people. And I was, they're so much more positive. They were so much more positive in New York. You know, I'd gone from all this negative, everything going wrong, to, wow, this is fantastic. Let's do this. Let's do that. And, you know, that was something that stayed with me for the rest of my career. You know, that New York.
One thing, you know, I loved working there. Your drive. I mean, it's everything you talk about shows immense drive in your life, like the commitment and drive of taking risks and doing things, it seems to be there all the way along. Have you ever sort of sat back and and analyzed, or even, you know, I've been to therapy a lot, and I've sort of seen where my drive came from. And it's actually, you know, we sort of identified it was that my father didn't show much interest in me. So I've sort of been trying to get his attention is the idea in my life. That's where we honed it down to. Have you ever looked at something like that in terms of your own drive and where it may have came from?
Well, I never really thought about my father because he was never around, and frankly, he seemed like a bit of a prat. I mean, I didn't meet him a couple of times later on when he was older, but then by that stage, I was a pop star, and I really wasn't interested. I had no, like, oh my God, my father. No, I was always driven, always have been, but it's not a good idea to turn around and analyze too much what you're doing. Or, I mean, if I'd analyzed where I was going, what I'm doing, I mean, I mean, crazy, headstrong, do every, you know what I mean? But you can do that when you're young, can't you? You can attack the world, you know?
But you did attack the world, didn't you? I mean, some people was, the result of this was then some people, and this album, which then you came back with. And how did the record company react to the product that you actually presented them with?
They loved it. They loved it. I mean, the thing is, I was really lucky that EMI were very supportive. Polyphone, EMI were very supportive, and they loved the album. The big problem that they had was, and this is what we first started off when we were talking, is everything in the 70s and 80s was categorized. You were a new romantic. You were a rock band. You were, I wasn't anything. I was a guy, a pretty middle-class guy who wasn't political, with white hair, who was English, who'd made a record in New York, and the marketing people at EMI had an appallingly bad time at trying to get it across. I mean, you know, there's no question that Imagination survived, and some people have both survived 40 years, but at the time it was like, well, what's this, you know? I remember Radio 1, Capital would never play Imagination. Who does he think he is making a record with the Chic people, I mean, that was the direct on Monday morning. He's like, well, who does he think he is, you know? There was that rubbish. So Imagination and some people were both re-released. And it was Gary Davis who got Imagination away because he was playing on Radio 1. Here we are. We've got a song called Imagination by a guy called Bluey Sum. Have a listen. Oh, he said, and halfway at the end, he said, that's good. I'll play it again. And he played it twice. And that's what broke Imagination. So,
that's fascinating because you're talking about radio there. And how radio had such an impact at that during that era. And we're already in the 80s in America, we're in the MTV era.
Yeah.
Where
it was vital to me, you know. So
yeah, absolutely. And I think that was one of the most interesting choices, was when you came to make a video for Imagination
and
Storm Thorgerson. So was that your decision, or did that come from the record company?
My manager by this stage, I had an American manager and I had Bill Kirby in England, but my manager, they were all very close to MTV and the Barrows were very close to MTV. So I sort of did my naughty version of Imagination, which is the video. I went to Storm, Paul Barrows' idea, I think. But we went to Storm, who was a genius, you know, a nutty, but a genius. And so we want to do a 12-inch version. And this is what we want, the concept. And we're not stupid. I mean, we had MTV in the States involved the whole way through. They did a special on a video that they couldn't show. That's the irony. So they were involved right from the beginning. And we did a launch of the actual with MTV. So MTV News in New York, when in the States, was at the launch of the video that they couldn't show. because no one had really done that before. And the reason was, it was to programming. I knew that, if you remember, Steve, every club and bar in the world had these big screens that would come down. It was a no-brainer. If you wanted to be shown all night, every night, in every bar in the world, do something that was a bit risky. So that's what we did.
No, I remember that. I remember when seeing Michael Jackson's Billie Jean in a club in London, in a gay club in London, where they brought down the screens at midnight and showed this video, and they did it with Thriller, and we just stood there and watched it like it was completely normal.
And you're sort of like, wow. I mean, and the thing is, so that's what happened. And of course, you know, it completely is a massive dance hit all over the world. And, you know, still, meanwhile, you've got radio going, well, who does he think he is? Because, you know, it wasn't broken by radio imagination, you know. And of course, all the Europeans picked up on it long before England. So, that's what we did with the video. And then Storm did Some People with Storm, which was also, as you know, a commercial in the States. But that was
just going back to the other one, because you said, you know, it was shown. Wasn't it shown in Studio 54 as the first?
Yeah, the launch was Studio 54. And the thing about Studio 54, you know, it was still happening, Studio 54, but it wasn't like the days of, you know, everyone crawling around in the basement doing whatever. But it was still a good place to grab some attention. And so I wasn't at the launch, but, you know, MTV and everyone and all the record companies and it was a great place to launch it. And I I'd forgotten that, you see, until fairly recently as well. But it was all part of the whole risque thing. I should say, from the first minute I started doing this, I knew that America, sorry, UK, was far more important. So I would always, what about the Americans? I mean, I would, you know, I knew that Capital in LA was more important than, you know, I was a London-based act and I love London, but I knew that you had to get American.
I mean, you mentioned the Barrow brothers, the importance of their role in it, because they'd already had Girls on Film, hadn't they, with Duran Duran,
yeah.
I presume. Well, that was the forerunner, in essence, to the idea.
Actually, that's what Mike Paul said. It's been really, it's shown in every club in the world. It's about, you know, so let's do the same with you, with Imagination, because Imagination worked like that. And Storm was the perfect director for that, because he was a genius, but barking mad, you know. And I had no idea really what was going on most of the time. I mean, I had loads of meetings. And I got a feeling that we actually got some money out of Playboy for that video. I was thinking about it the other day. I think Playboy put up like $50,000 as well, so that they could show it exclusively at late night. So, I mean, we would take money from anyone. We're not proud. I mean, so, it was an event. And of course it gave me a calling card, you know, the Imagination video.
Weirdly, I was talking to a friend from MTV the other day because of, you know, interviewing you. And I said to him, didn't we go round Storm Thorgerson's? And he said, yeah, I think you did an interview with him. So did he live? He lived in North London or in...
Yeah, that's right. He had a barking mad studio up there with...
Kentish Town or something. It was something
like...
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I did interview him. No, and he was absolutely nuts, but very, very clever. And, you know, his work is fascinating.
He's genius nuts. I mean, he you know, every sleeve of Note and art campaign, you know, Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin, everything is Storm. If you look at his, what he did, I loved him. I thought he was great. And he was, you know, the record companies hated him. You know, he was like, no, I'm not doing that. No, you can piss off. You're not coming to the set. You know, I mean, he was ruthless and he was incredibly rude to everyone. But he was a fantastic guy. I liked him a lot.
You're listening to Pop, the History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
Did you have a say in anything that was going on then? Or was he actually just ordering you around?
No, but I mean, there was an element of that, but you have to imagine that I've got to this stage, I'm not going to let it go. I mean, I always had a say in everything. That's why maybe it hadn't gone according to plan a lot of the time. But no, I mean, I did. I knew what the basic, you know, concept of the video was. It was, some of the things he made me do were a bit embarrassing. It was quite a big film set, and it was a Monday morning we started shooting. It was a long shoot, like 4 or 5 days. I said, right, get your clothes off then. I said, what? I said, you know, he said, you don't think that they're going to walk around naked and you're not? And then I'm looking around at all these people, and it's my first really big shoot. And I'm like, you know, I'm freaking out. Anyway, I did what I was told. I got in the shower. So if you remember the opening scene is I'm standing in the shower, but I'm looking terrified, you know.
Well, I think you're looking away, actually.
I have to look away for obvious reasons, Steve.
From behind, yes.
Yes. Thank God, yes.
Yeah. Oh dear. But yeah. I mean, that's, you know, I think those times in your life are sort of very pivotal, and you may not even realize it at the time. Did you know you were at a pivotal moment?
Oh, yes. I knew every time, even though every day. I mean, I never took a minute off, you know. I mean, I was on the phone. I had a big bag of coins, and everywhere I drove in London in those days, you drove everywhere. I'd stop and there would be a payphone. I'd be on the phone to America with my coins, you know. I'll call you back in 10 minutes then. I'd drive another, you know, round, because you could drive around. And every moment was pivotal. I knew I had one chance. And everything went really, really well. I mean, you know, on that album, and then Queen with Freddie Mercury when Freddie asked me to do the tour. Obviously, by this stage, EMI are really taking me seriously. And then,
how did he approach you?
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Well, I had approached Queen, the band, not Freddie, at a manager director's conference. They were in a special VIP part of the hotel, and I was about 11 o'clock at night, and I said to the girl from the record company, a friend of mine, she was fantastic, I said, I've got to get on this tour. There was talk of a tour. I said, I've got to make friends with them. So anyway, I was barged into their room, and I always remember telling Roger and John, listen, you need some young blood on your tour, you know, if you do it. And we had a drink. It was a laugh. But how I got the tour was Montreux. And there was a big TV festival, and it was 86, and everyone and their auntie was there. And Queen were about to launch the Magic Tour, which in those days was the biggest thing ever. It was a stadium tour. It hadn't happened before. And I got summoned at the party afterwards. The managing director of EMI came down and said, Peter James came down and said, Freddie wants to meet you. And so I was taken upstairs, and then Freddie was like, this is the only star of the show. You, the rest of them are all average. You are the one. This is the one doing my tour. And the managing director's like, Freddie, we can't afford it. We can't. Don't be ridiculous, darling. Spend the money. So I got the tour.
That's fantastic. Yeah. I love it. But when you actually went on tour with them, you'd already had this massive preparation, because you'd played small clubs at the beginning. You'd had a real band. Were you perceived as a
live act,
or were you perceived as a video act? Because in a way, you crossed that boundary of both, didn't you?
I think I was different from most of them, because most 80s acts were video acts. They weren't live acts, if you think, except for the big ones like Duran and Tears and whatever. But I was very definitely a live act. I mean, I was on the road. I was touring, playing all the time. It was really important to me, because I knew you couldn't crack America unless you were playing the whole time. So if you look now at a lot of the 80s acts, the great bands, ABCs and Heaven 70s and everything, they weren't playing live in the 80s. I mean, they were making great videos and amazing records, but they weren't So I was, yeah, I was out there. I was playing, and I loved it, actually. That was the bit I really enjoyed. So, I had a band that I, you know, a great band. I mean, they were fantastic. So for me, it was easy to slot in. I was playing all the way through the summer anyway. And so when Queen gave me those dates, you know, it was easy.
Was that around the time you were also touring with Frankie Goes to Hollywood?
No, that was a year before.
To me, that sounds like a marriage made in hell, to the extent of that would have been wild.
It was very wild. It was very wild. And also, I'm perceived by everyone in those days, I was perceived as being quite posh. And they were, you know, hooligans. I mean, you know, Holly is obviously now, a lovely guy, and he was always a slightly more genteel than the rest of them, but the rest of them were animals. And I always remember the first few dates, like, my band could outdrink them anyway. So that was the first thing. So we weren't wimps. And I just think that I'd been in America a lot, so there was a lot of MTV buzz around me. So they were like, "Well, who is this guy?" They didn't dive in and start. They'd done a tour before where they'd been really badly behaved, and no one would do press with them on this tour. So I got all the press. So it worked for me really well. So whenever we turned up in a town, I would do everything. They were very big by this stage. I mean, people don't have any concept of how big Frankie Goes to Hollywood were. I mean, Relax and Two Tribes, as you remember, are phenomenal, you know, they were really phenomenal. I grabbed their press. We got on really well.
They also had them. You know, when you think of Relax, they had that first, you know, band video as well. I was actually, there's this girl with really long blonde hair behind the bar, Ange, who was a mate of mine. And she's in that video. That was sort of her claim to fame at the time. And they also, you know, I don't want to say used it, because that sounds like...
Well, they got their record deal on that, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. And it was, you know, and that video is incredible because it is like pushing the
it's on the cube, you remember?
And then they had to remake the video, didn't they, with sort of these strobe lights or whatever they're called. And
that original is just phenomenal.
It's absolutely brilliant. How did it feel in that period to you about where you were going to end up?
Well, at that stage, I was convinced and everything was going very well. And then I went to New York to do my second album, and I had a live band that consisted of Carlos Alomar, Carmine Rojas on bass, Jeff Dugmore, Guy Fletcher, you know, from Dire Straits, Chester Kamen. I was going to use the Borneo horns for brass, Robin Clark, and goodness knows who else on backing vocals. I had the most amazing lineup, and we recorded the album, and that was it. And it was, we came back to London, the record company were thrilled, and I was thrilled. And we're ready to go. And then it all started to go horribly, horribly wrong. Did the first video. Tour dates were all organized. America's organized. Europe's organized. And then it went wrong. And what happened? You want to know what happened?
Went wrong? Yeah.
It's really straightforward. I mean, everything's slotted in. Radio One's playing it. It's climbing the charts. The record's released. And it's all to do with logistics in those days. There were rules about you could only release a couple of weeks before to radio before it went out on sale. And if you remember, it's just before it's the MTV time. It's the same time as I met Mark. We became chums. The record's due to be released on Monday, the whatever, and it wasn't in the stores. So Radio One pulled it. So it's suddenly all airplay stops, the single's dead. The Europeans are going, hang on, wait a minute, it's not a hit in the UK, it's downgraded. Americans go, right, it's downgraded. So it's Let It Be With You. It was, by this stage, it's top five in America dance. The video's on heavy rotation in the States. Everything's going according to plan. Boom, it wasn't there. The guy, the head of sales and distribution at EMI had gone on holiday, and there'd been a mess up with the dates of the records going to the stores. I mean, you know, I know it sounds really basic, but that's what happened. Once it's pulled from Radio One in those days, that was it. It was over. It never came back. He never got it back. I'd struggled for the whole year. We released lots of singles, but radio, no, it's not going to happen. Blue Sun's not happening. You know? So it was over.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
And also, obviously, the 80s, it was, you know, music was changing and the society was changing.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it was 87, 88, I used to go to Shoom and the sort of the rave culture was coming.
Yeah. But I've transformed into leather jacket and jeans. If you look at the second album, you know, it's live band. It's all live band, the second album. It's not so electronic, and even though the first one wasn't that electronic, but you know what I mean, it was not relying on it was brass, it was rock guitar, it was much heavier. And so I'd moved, I'd developed. I mean, I was going to Shroom and all the clubs, and that's where London was, you know. I was doing all the same thing, so I wasn't, you know, silly. No, it had gone wrong. And it, you know, it's the end of the 80s and you're just about to get there and you haven't got there. Now, a lot of bands that we know now did get there. They just got there maybe a year earlier than me. They you know, if you think of all the bands that have survived, the big ones, you know, the obvious ones, the 80s bands, but I hadn't got there. And so the whole thing, you know, it just, everyone was very nice and we carried on, but you know, it was over.
How did you deal, because you know, this is taking a bit later, sort of to the mid-90s, when you know, the end came, as it were.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a similar period with me. I'd come to Germany, run a TV channel, and then my career completely fell apart and I was over. And there was a process of the loss of fame, which was, even though I was nowhere near as successful as you, but I was recognizable at that point.
I remember
that loss. Yeah. That loss of fame was quite painful in a way. It was like a loss that you go through in life. There's some sort of grief involved where you get used to it slowly in an acceptance, and then you deal with it and then you move on. How was that for you?
Well, I knew it long before everyone else. So, I mean, I was like, this is not going according to plan, and I couldn't get tours and I did an American tour in 1988, small club tour, but I should have been doing something much bigger. And then I was looking at the management, and then there was some bad management advice. And, you know, then I really, really fought to make a third album, which is, I think, a beautiful album that, you know, BMG Arista didn't even bother with. I don't know why they bothered making it, but we made it. And I released that. It's got a couple of great singles on it, but they didn't, you know, they didn't even bother. So, you know what? I thought, that's it. You know, I mean, that's it. Because by the time it's the 90s, and I didn't like the 90s. The 90s were, you know, they weren't fooling anyone to me. They were, you know, Britpop was really, yeah, okay. I mean, I've just lived through the 80s. I'm not interested, you know. So I thought it was best. I've jumped ahead a bit, but I thought it was best, rather than be groveling around. I've still lived in central London. I thought, just keep quiet. I still chatted to all my friends who were in the music industry, but I kept, you know, it was very humiliating. It's very annoying. It's very frustrating. It's there's the guy that did Imagination, you know, there's a lot of that. And
I mean, what's interesting about that, I mean, that's what I used to get. It's like, oh, it's MTV, you know. Yeah. And of course, to them, I'm the identifiable figure, and they mean that in a positive way. But to you, it's like a memory of what's gone in a way.
Yeah. And I was embarrassed.
It is quite painful.
It is very painful, but you can't say anything or do anything. You just got to smile sweetly and go, oh, yeah, right. You know, you just reminded me of the fact it's gone wrong, you know. And, oh, I love that song, you know, oh, great. Or, you know, and in America, oh, so what happened? A lot of what's gone wrong? What's happened? Well, what's gone wrong is real life has gone wrong. And you know, I chose show business. If you choose show business, you're playing with fire, you know. And you know, I scratched around, and I think I made a single with, funnily enough, I made a single with Matt and Biff, who about a month before they started recording the Spice Girls. So I did a cover, a Korea song, Baby Let Me Love You, which is great. Actually, again, I hadn't heard that for 20 minutes. And then I thought, you know, this is 1995. This is crazy. What am I doing? Who am I kidding? You know, you know, I'm not making any money. I've got to get on and move on. So I kept quiet and let them all get on with it, you know.
So then, you've had a long, you know, a long period after that. And just a couple of years ago, which I think would have been just slightly pre-COVID, you made a decision to actually
come out of your shell. Someone called me up. I mean, my kids didn't even know I was a singer. No one knew I was a singer. I mean, my friends knew I was Bluey Sun, but I, you know, the first thing happened about 10 years ago, I lost a lot of weight and looked a lot better because, you know, you get to 45, 50, you know, it's like, I got a phone call. I was on the beach in Croatia. I was actually in the water with someone rang and said, oh, do you fancy doing Let's Rock next year? You know, all 12 festivals. I said, yeah. Okay. They said, well, we'll send you a contract. I said, well, what do I have to do? Don't worry, it's in the contract. Okay, fine. That was it. And I did it. And that was one of the big moments in my life as well, going back on stage for the first time in 25, 30 years. That was.
How surprised were you with the reaction that you got when you went back on stage?
I was completely surprised. I mean, the last gigs I did, you know, there was a confrontation between band and audience. When you're a young band, it's a lot of like, but going on to an audience that actually knew all the words and liked you, and they weren't throwing things at you or you know, they were it was incredible. A great band as well, because, you know, technically everything's so much better now. So I went on and I was completely shocked. It was a big moment in my life, and my kids were there like, that was nice. And but the big thing, Steve, and you'll know this because you've met everyone, right? In I haven't seen these people for 30 years. No one. I haven't seen any band for 30 years. And there was a lineup with 12 bands, all ages. You know, the ABCs, Nick Kershaw. I toured with Nick. You know, I mean, all people I'd known, you know, reasonably well. Some I'd known very well, Tony Hadley, whatever. And it was like yesterday. Oh, hi, Neff. Yeah, I was like, well, hang on. Aren't you going to ask me where I've been for 30 years? You know, it was like yesterday.
Yeah, there's a loyalty, isn't there? And there's, I mean, I'm finding that with the interviews that I do, that because there's a commonality that we've all experienced something of the same in the people of that era, and particularly for you as musicians who have been out there and been successful, you've had very similar experiences along the way. None of them have stayed right up the top.
They've all had a terrible time at some stage, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and they know what it's like to be at the top, and they know what it's like when it's taken away. Yeah. And I think that's the beauty of it.
That was lovely.
It gives you more humanity to understand that.
That was lovely. And that didn't exist 40 years ago, let me tell you. There was none of that backstage at Wembley with Queen on stage. Like, you know, we were all competing. But there's no competing now. That's a very good point. There was no competing. Everyone was like, hi, how are you doing? All right, blah, 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 blah. You know, I mean, it was nice. It's a very, very nice feeling to be around, a comradeship, you know. We've all been through the same war together, and like old soldiers. It was it was great. It was very lovely, actually. And the people who run these the Let's Rock, they're the biggest festivals in the UK. I mean, the retro ticket is bigger than anything now, because people in their 40s and 50s plus can afford to go. I mean, and it was just great. I mean, really nice, you know. No one pissed backstage, that's for a start. none of that, you know.
Come on, you're all backstage taking tons of coke and going shitless, aren't you?
No, everyone's looking around, everyone's like, you know, no, there's none of that happening. It's, excuse me, where's my, you know, do I still need a hairbrush? You know, that was no, it was very civilized indeed, and all family, and I loved that, you know. Because, you know, we have lived through it. And any young band that thinks they've seen it all, yeah, right. You know, you try living in the 70s and 80s. You want to see what it's like? It was...
I just want to ask you finally, because that going on stage and having that experience again, and then seeing that the audience know all your songs and sing along and they're with you still, which is, you know, a really fantastic moment. Has it inspired you to write new songs and to actually think about, let's take this to another level? What will you do now?
Well, all my interviews when I was doing the festivals was, no, don't be ridiculous, I'm not doing that, you know. And then I was rummaging through moving, and we were rummaging through boxes, and I realised I did demo an entire album in the mid-90s, early, you know, to do another album. So I have got some great, and I listened to songs, I thought, you know, because I was a songwriter, you know, and the songs sounded, I mean, now if I wrote a song, it'd be rubbish. But these songs I wrote 15, 20 years ago, and yeah, I have an album, and it's fantastic, but I ain't doing it. Well, unless someone comes along and says, listen, I'm not going to go through what I went through in the past. If someone comes along and says, hey, I really want to work with you, we'll do a couple of songs, you know, and I would like to do that one day, but I'm not sweating just to prove a point, you know. But I'd like to do lots of live stuff.
My advice is don't be proud. Just do it, because, you know.
If someone turns up and says, I'll do it, I'll pay for it and whatever, and yeah, then I would do it. But, you know, I'm not going to go out like I did in the old days and go, come on, you can work with me. I know I can get people to work with me, but I don't want to, you know. We'll see what happens. I want to do live, more live, before everyone my age keels over, you know. We're the next, you know, while the Stones and all that lot are still going strong, there's hope.
That is such a brilliant note to end on. Neville, it's been an absolute pleasure to catch up. And I'm really pleased that you're doing so well and have such great stories to tell. And you're a little bit like me. You think back at the past, you talk about it, and then suddenly you think, oh, God, that happened. And then comes a new story. So thanks again. Good luck with the future. And really, your contribution has been immense in that era. And it was a pleasure for me to go back and to listen to the music again and just sort of take me back to another era, and that was fantastic in itself.
Thank you so much.
And that's it for this interview with Neville, or Baloui Sum. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I do, and I'll see you next time.
When you save on auto insurance for driving safe with USAA Safe Pilot, you'll feel like a big deal. Even in a traffic jam. Save up to 30% with USAA Safe Pilot. Restrictions apply.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.